Early one Saturday morning in 1503, in a small backwater in the south of France, there was born a boy named Michel de Nostradamus. Why his mother straightaway abandoned him, bought a trampoline, and moved in with the director of the Archaeopteryx Palindrome Society in a village south of Marseille is fodder for another story.
That's not a palindrome.
Well, that's fodder for another story.
Okay.
Yeah, that'll...
Why did she do that? I don't know.
It's fodder for another story.
Well, tell me about the tyke.
The tyke. Oh, all right. Anyway, the tyke appeared normal in all respects, save for one small detail. Actually, it wasn't small at all. It was rather big, and it was his nose.
I was hoping it was going to clang.
Clang.
There it is. Nose clangs.
In fact, at first the midwife who attended the birth thought that neonate had two heads. But then he sneezed, and the nasaline matter that spewed aplenty from those two hubcap-sized apertures convinced her that this simply was a major leak beezer.
What kind of hubcaps did they have in 1503?
That's fodder for another story. And so she gave him the name that would define him throughout his life, Nostradamus.
Nostradamus. Okay.
Okay.
I see what's coming.
His nose proved to be somewhat of a dichotomy. On the one hand, its extreme sensitivity came in handy as he tried his hand, or nose really, at the perfume trade. Nostradamus was a natural, and before he was 8 years old, he was producing a best-selling line of heady colognes. On the other hand, or septum really, the Inquisition considered his beak a heretical organ and threatened to burn it at the stake if he didn't keep it out.
Oh, sorry.
That was the Spanish Inquisition. This is the French, or is it? They threatened to burn it at the stake if he didn't keep it out of other people's business, which included all of the fearsome tribunal's parfumier pals. So Nostradamus shelved his burgeoning career in odorifics and enrolled in the medical school at l'Université de Montpellier. A year later, and it was a temperate year, for in those days, Vermont's capital city abutted the Mediterranean Sea. He graduated cum schnozzel with a degree in otorhinolaryngology. Oh, Nostradamus was quite adept at diagnosing and treating people's ailing ears and throats, but he positively excelled at fixing their snoots. In all of France, there wasn't a bugle he couldn't unstuff, a beezer bleed he couldn't stanch. But the deeper he looked into his client's nasaline corridors, the more he saw things that were super anatomical. Indeed, he saw the future. The cilia, the sebaceous glands, the clots of mucus, the implanted alien transponders, each in its own way rang a prophetical bell in Nostradamus. At first, he freely told his customers what he divined from their honkers' interiors. It could be as trifling as in what key an impending bout of borborygmus would sound, or as weighty as how much a chap would tip the scales at mortal coil checkout time. One day, he caught a glimpse of his own sniffer from a reflection in a millpond, and the events that he foresaw in his future were remarkable, to say the least. But then he factored in the reflection, and the prophecy was quickly reduced to,
"Tu rencontreras un étranger grand et foncé."
Or,
"You will meet a tall, dark stranger."
Eventually, word of his paranormal prowess filtered back to the Inquisition, which summarily ordered...
Paranormal proboscis?
That too. Which summarily ordered him to cease his prognostications. Or else. He complied. Sort of. Instead of saying the sooth aloud, Nostradamus began to write it down in abstruse quatrains. He obfuscated their meanings by employing metaphor, symbolism, and pig Latin. Thus, the members of the tribunal, who were ignorant of swine language and had no use for either metal floors or symbols, were unable to attest, to arrest, and try him as a magician. Quatrain number 153, though technically a quintrain, is typical.
There once was a man from Nantucket, Lord Henry the Eighth in a bucket. The Habsburgs protested, and Akbar conquested. Beware, Airy May Winkwe of Otske.
You see, quite incomprehensible to the uninitiated. But to those schooled in abstractions and abstrusions, it overflowed with meaning. Although Nostradamus continued to mend the occasional broken-down beak, more and more he settled comfortably into the role of fortune-teller. His business cards featured but three words.
Le ne connaît.
Or?
The nose, she knows. Oh, no, that's four words. She knows, knows.
And everyone, save for the Inquisition and its assigns, knew what that meant. As the years passed, Nostradamus experienced firsthand the often deplorable conditions in which prophets were forced to work, the frequently fetid nose holes he encountered, for example, and he determined to improve them. He teamed up with a taxidermist friend in Avignon with similar concerns, and together they formed the Guild of Seers and Roebucks. One evening in the summer of 1566, a gout-stricken Nostradamus, sensing that his health was taking a nosedive, summoned a priest to perform the last rites. The seer had never before seen the clergyman who showed up. However, he bore an uncanny resemblance to the description from the millpond reflection that still haunted his memory. He was preternaturally tall, caliginously dark, and his strangeness knew no bounds. The ears were distinctly chiropteran, the arms ended in gnarled claws. The upper incisors were chiseled to jagged points. But it was his snoot that sounded the red alert on the bizarrometer. Is that a crow?
That's a red alert.
Oh, right.
It's the best I can do.
Of course.
You lost your place.
I did.
You did a pretty good job on that.
Sure. It faded into and out of focus. But when it was visible, it was simply too grotesque for polite description. Suffice it to say that it would have looked right at home in a blunderbuss factory. As the priest hovered over him and administered, well, they were so ominous as to be more like the last wrongs, Nostradamus perceived the most chilling images imaginable lodged in the stranger's hunker holes. The prognosticator predicted that it wasn't the gout that would kill him, but rather the two little holes that were about to appear on his neck, courtesy of the vampire Nosferatu. Today's 458th episode of Kalfos and Damien's Nose Music Bazaar features fragrant music by New York composer Nose Rolnick. Introduced by
Neil Nosnick.
Neil Nosnick. Introduced by our own musical cognoscenti, Kalnos.
I am smelling it all.
Are you?
We are putting aromas into the atmosphere. And I am so happy to have brought along the chuck full of nuts guitar for today's event.
Sort of a kithara. A kithara.
Oh, well. All right. Enough of that. We'll listen to...
Never enough.
We'll listen to some more Neil Rolnick. We just heard from his Macedonian air drumming. We heard a piece by Neil Rolnick and Barbara Benari, David Demnitz, Nick Ditkovsky, and Daniel Good. For Gamelan Instruments and Real-Time Digital Processing.
Boy, the whole New York
Gamelan
crew.
Son of Lion, Riri Bong. And now from his CD, Fish Love That. Fish Love That. They love that. They love that. This is the first cut. Recorded live, this. And this is called Those Cows, They Never Came Home. I'm
Now, surely this has some bearing on today's show.
It does. Neil Rolnick and Fish Love That. That was doing a Todd Reynolds tune, Those Cows, They Never Came Home. Interesting CD, and he talks about things in today's interview with Neil B. Rolnick. He talks about improvisation. You know, a dirty word for a long time.
It certainly is.
And it came up recently several times, not only in our interviews, but with discussions among other composers. I had one last night where the topic of improvisation came up again, and it was the word that could not be spoken for a number of years during the avant-garde, where you could do aleatory, and you could do interaction and performance art, and you could do everything, but you dare not do improvisation.
No.
So, shall we go to that interview? It's a long interview with Neil B. Rolnick today.
We have to start soon.
Okay. A fun gent.
Oh, good.
He's a lot of fun. Sometimes he acts professorial, because he is one.
Hmm.
And so some of his stories are extended.
I see. That will account for the nose, will it?
It will. So let's go to New York and our guest, Neil B. Rolnick.
Okay.
It's Calvos and Damien on the road. We're here with the only guy I can possibly imagine in the world who could have written the piece about one of Vermont's utilities.
This is true.
And it's probably the main reason I opened that CD and played it right away was to see, what do you mean Central Vermont Public Service?
Anyway, does it sound like Central Vermont Public Service?
No, it wasn't as erratic. It was much more stable than the power was ever from CVPS. Anyway, Neil Rolnick is our guest. This is just great. Welcome to Calvus.
Thank you.
How did you get, let's just start with that, and we'll, then we'll get to your background, but how did you get inspired to do a piece of, that was titled after utility companies?
Well, because I had at that point moved around a lot, and now this is about 13, 14 years later, and I've been moving some, but haven't been moving as much, but at that point I was really interested in sort of looking at how the piece was called Electricity.
Electricity, right.
And it's out on the OO Discs label. And at the time I wrote the piece, I was beginning to sort of look at how my thinking for working with electronics coincided with my thinking about acoustic music. The piece is about 45 minutes long. It's into, I think, 13 or 14 separate pieces or movements. And I got to thinking about how I had moved all these different places, and in each one I was more dependent than anything upon the electric company to supply me with the power that I was using to make the music. And so there it goes.
That's amazing. Just great. Why don't we just one second, we'll start out with that one cut, just because it's appropriate for our audience. From Electricity by Neil Rolnick, this is Central Vermont Public Service. Neil Rolnick from Electricity, Central Vermont Public Service. Okay, now we can get to the background.
Okay.
Let's take you back to when you became interested in creating music on a sort of a composer level versus a player level, and maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah, well, it actually, I started out on the composer level. When I was in high school, I started playing the piano kind of late, 13, 14 years old. Immediately started trying to imitate what I was playing in my lessons by writing them.
So you were late, too, on that. You know, that's
yeah.
really interesting.
Yeah.
I rarely meet anybody. I started late, too, with it, and mm-hmm. I rarely meet anybody who started late.
Huh. Yeah, so I started, I mean, I played folk music before that, and I, you know, I played guitar and accordion and banjo.
You played accordion.
Yeah.
Good for you.
And and cello a little bit in elementary school, but then none of it really stuck a whole lot until I started studying first in Connecticut where I lived, and then I
so where were you in Connecticut at the
Westport
time? Westport, yeah.
And there was a school of music there, and I started playing piano and immediately wanted to start imitating what I was doing by writing similar things, and then hooked up with a wonderful man here in the city that I would come in and spend all through high school. I spent every Saturday with this guy. His name is Fritz Kramer. He was a musicologist from the Manhattan School, and he also gave the lectures before the Philharmonic concerts.
Uh-huh.
And I would come in, and we would do he was an old guy from Germany, and we would do a piano lesson where I'd study the regular piano literature, and then we'd do a species counterpoint lesson, and then we would do a 18th century counterpoint lesson. And then he was really into Hindemith, so we would do a kind of a Ludus Tonalis type counterpoint lesson. Then we would do harmonizations, and then we would do 12 tone studies, and then we would do imitations of all the piano music I was studying. And then
that's a pretty adventurous Saturday afternoon.
Then I'd have free composition, so I'd always be working on a separate piece.
Wow.
And so that was like all through high school, and it was more work than getting my doctorate was. But
that's absolutely incredible.
It was wonderful. And also all through that, so I always felt like my piano playing was way behind my ability to think musically and write it down. And then when I sort of went to college, stopped being a music major, did other things.
What sort of other things? I'm always curious.
I ended up as a literature major, uh-huh. And I wrote a novel that is sitting in a drawer someplace.
I know a great website that'll be happy to publish it.
I don't know if I really want it. Every now and then I go back and take a look at it. Well, I could scan it in and give it to you.
You betcha.
That's interesting.
Sorry. Yeah.
And all through that time, I was actually sort of making extra money by playing. I started to learn how to play. More simply, so that I was playing in square dance bands and rock and roll bands and folk music folk dance groups around Cambridge and New England, and then went out to California for a while and played rock and roll and jazz, and met some people who kind of taught me how to not think like a composer, but think, well, I don't know if it's think like a composer. They taught me how to not think so much like a European composer.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And how to...
Tell us something about that, because there is a different kind of consciousness.
Yeah.
What did you learn about
Well, I learned to simplify. I learned that I could play triads. That was okay. I learned that I could make steady rhythms instead of things that were so complex you couldn't hear them. I couldn't hear them.
Uh-huh.
And to worry about how things sounded rather than how they looked on the paper. And so I did that in California a bunch, and this was 1969, 70, 71. It was draft time, lottery time.
We all remember our numbers. Right?
Yeah, I think I was something like 3 or something. I was right up there, and so I ended up being a conscientious objector, at one point while living in California, I was sort of bouncing back and forth between the coasts, and a friend of mine convinced me to go to Alaska where we were going to make millions of dollars fishing, and got up there and lost everything, and...
How far did you get?
Anchorage.
That's far enough.
And my friend went on and became an oceanographer and is really into the ocean. But I, when I spent my last $5 in Anchorage.
In a bar, right?
Yeah. that's it. And came back down to, back in those days when you graduated from college, you got all these credit card companies sent you credit cards.
Oh, yes.
So I had these credit cards in my wallet. I had left my dog in Cambridge. I left my car in San Francisco. So I completely ran out of money. Used my credit card to fly back to Cambridge and get my dog, and then fly me and the dog back to San Francisco. And then I threw away the credit cards.
You didn't like finish paying them off like last year then?
I actually finished paying them off. In the following years, after this, I ended up doing my conscientious objector first in Wyoming, where I worked driving an ambulance, working in a hospital, and also learning about country western music, which I really enjoyed. I played saxophone in a country western band.
Really? Wow.
I never
could
play much saxophone, but you didn't need a whole lot. Yeah, these big parties at these clubs in Jackson, which is where I was. And then I got fired for organizing the hospital workers.
Oh, my God.
I said, you can't do that. You know, this is through the government. I have a conscientious objector job here. And they said, well... The hospital administrator said...
They said it's that or die.
He said they need me, the administrator, here more than they need you, the orderly. So, tough luck, buddy.
Wow.
You know, go find a lawyer, and the nearest lawyer is over across the border in Idaho Falls, and he's on my board. So then I was... sort of hooked on finding interesting places. Having been in sort of before the CO job in California, doing lots of playing rock and roll and jazz, and then having to do this 2 years service and half of it done in Wyoming, I was sort of hooked on pretty places. That's how I got in Wyoming after being in Alaska. I thought, well, either I'll go to LA and do studio stuff while I'm doing it, or I'll just go to the prettiest place I can think. So, kicked out of Wyoming, I ended up back in Vermont.
From Fish Love That, an ensemble that was Ratchet, his own composition. Our guest is Neil B. Rolnick. We'll be getting right back to him after we do, just a little tad of business. Do you think we can do that?
Depends on how quickly you can turn the button.
Hello? There you are. I knew you'd come in the studio.
Hi, I'm Laurie Anderson, and you're listening to California Music Bazaar, your one stop for non-pop
the most local of the non-pop international networks.
Here on WGDR Plainfield.
Flagship of.
The Non-Pop International Network. Let's go right back to our interview with Neil B. Rolnick.
So, kicked out of Wyoming, I ended up back in Vermont, which was the next place.
And where were you in Vermont?
At not far from you, in Brookfield.
Brookfield. Wow. You know, when I currently live in Northfield Falls, which is nearby. I used to live in Roxbury.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. Well, we were right near the floating bridge between Brookfield and Randolph. And I think between routes 12 and 14, is that right?
12 and 14, that's right. You remember and, those days.
And there... I was playing in rock and roll bands and stuff and started...
One of the great sort of jingle writers lives right in that area.
Oh, who's that?
By the name of Bobby Gosch.
Oh.
And he probably most notorious for the Burger King commercials of about 10 years ago.
Oh, really?
It was right in that area near the floating bridge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? That's lovely, lovely area. And I managed to find a wife there, which was nice. And we're still married.
Oh, well, both of those things are good.
Yes, yes. And that was 30 years ago. And at that point, somewhere in there, my parents decided that they were moving to, you know, downsizing to a smaller house, wanted to give away the piano that I had actually bought for $1,000 with money I had saved up when I was 14. It was an old Steinway L. Oh. And... first I said, okay, then I said, no, you know, you can't do that, and I'll take it, and I'll be responsible for it. And as soon as I got it up to our place in Vermont, I started playing and realized that I'd sort of been missing a lot about playing the piano.
Oh, my goodness.
Because
so
I just
really
had all clunkers.
Yeah, wow.
And so I started going, I started taking lessons again. Ultimately, didn't like the Vermont winters very much.
They are tough.
And wanted to move back to San Francisco, so I, on a lark, I had offered to join a rock and roll band in San Francisco. Thought on a lark that maybe since I was enjoying my piano lessons, I would apply to the San Francisco Conservatory. Went in thinking I was going to do a piano audition and heard the other pianist and said, oh, no, I'm not that good. I think I should just do a... composition application. So I went, I did the interview, then went home and wrote the compositions and that I told them that I had written. And and got in and it sort of got me back on the line. And the first person, actually the first teacher that I had there was John Adams, who was also in my class at Harvard. And that was, it was very interesting.
At that time, John Adams was would still have been not quite famous.
Not at all famous.
Yeah,
he was just, I mean, we were both about 3 years out of college. He was probably less because he did a master's. But he had really interesting ideas that I had sort of, at that point, getting back to contemporary music and new music, my thought of what was new was really, you know, Stockhausen and Boulez and Berio.
You still hadn't been cured of that by these people who taught you not to think European?
No, because that was rock and roll. And now I was getting back to serious stuff. And, you know, I mean, my experience with rock and roll and jazz was I played with a lot of people who couldn't read or couldn't read much and who didn't know anything about this other music I'd studied. And so that was just a different world. It was sort of like since then, you know, I've had many experiences where I've gone in and played with, you know, in Japan with Japanese traditional musicians or with traditional musicians in the Balkan Peninsula. And I don't go in and try and teach them about Western tradition of music. That would be silly. I try and find a place where we can meet.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was sort of how I felt playing pop music or playing rock back in the 60s and early 70s, was I just sort of didn't bother bringing along all that other baggage. But sort of being in San Francisco for those years, and I was really based in San Francisco pretty much with the time in Wyoming and Vermont taken out from 69 through 1980, 81. And there was a lot, you know, that was the first I heard of, you know, Steve Reich and Philip Glass and Lamont Young and, the idea of thinking of Duke Ellington as a serious composer and
the sort of moments of change were beginning to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. And, so that was really, you know, very important for me. I feel like I learned a lot. Not, you know, I didn't really need to learn all the technical stuff.
Well, let's take a break now and listen to a piece that does not have that kind of pulse to it. This is also from the Electricity CD. This is Wondrous Love. Tell us a little bit about that. We'll play it and we'll come back to this biography.
Okay. Wondrous Love was written just about the time we're talking about, in the late 70s, I guess, 1978 maybe, Somewhere in there. It was the end of the time that I was in Paris studying at AIRCOM.
Oh, wait, what? Wait, how did Paris get into this story?
It was part of living in California.
I see.
Involved living in Paris for 2 years.
Fine, okay.
Except
for the time I spent in Wyoming, I mean, and Vermont.
Yeah, well, you know,
Paris.
During that time, like I said, the reason for Electricity having all those names was that I lived in a lot of cities.
Yeah.
But I was basically a Californian during that time. And I was part of the crew that came over from California to basically set up the technology at AIRCOM in 1977 through 79. And when I was in Paris, I ran into another person I had run into in California named Toyoji Tomita, who is a trombonist who now is still, I think, in the Bay Area. And I'd gone through finding out about all this other music and sort of thinking, well, maybe I don't have to be sounding like Stockhausen and Boulez if I'm going to write new music. So I found this shape note book of songs that felt very American, and wrote a piece for Toyoji with a solo trombone. It was sort of like the Berio Sequenzas, but with melody and harmony.
And
a real sense of sort of trying to think about who I am and who, where the music comes from and where I come from. And I was, of course, living, whenever you live abroad, I tend to feel a whole lot more American than I do when I live in America.
It's a great piece. I love this piece. Wondrous Love by our guest on Calvus and Damien, Neil Rolnick.
Thank you.
Wondrous Love, and that old shape note tune. I did an arrangement of that myself, but a very straightforward arrangement for a chorus.
Which is probably how it should be.
Oh,
but.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting how some specific tunes come around again.
It's a wonderful tune. It's just a wonderful tune.
Very evocative. That's a nice arch it has. We'll leave it to our listeners to go out and find a copy. Wondrous Love or What Wondrous Love, depending on the edition. So, gosh, took a little time off in Paris here. We're in this biographical segment.
Well, Paris was actually really, really interesting for me because I was still sort of not sure where I fit in things. I guess we're never sure where we fit. But when I got engaged in, I was working at ERCOM, which is, you know, the temple of modernism.
Yeah, it certainly is that.
And I went over there idolizing Boulez and Berlioz and Stockhausen, and you know, and I worked with all of them, and I worked with closely with Boulez and Berlioz. I had some interaction with Stockhausen. People like Jean-Claude Risset and Vinko Globokar were around and part of the crew. I didn't like the music I heard.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while to say, well, what's going on here?
Our only experience with ERCOM is me bribing the guard at the door to throw Damien out and take a picture of it. So that's as far as we got. We got as far as the guard and we handing him a few francs to help usher Damien out the door. So.
Well, you know, there were two things. One is that I found that I didn't like. I try from about that time, I try to think about what writing and playing what I hear, what I really hear. And I just don't hear all of that structural stuff that modernism is about. I on some level, I do hear a structure, but it's on I relate much more to the way that Steve Reich talks about structure in terms of it being something that you can hear evolve, something that you can hear change. And I'm, you know, hearing Rose going in every direction from Sunday doesn't do anything for me. Some connection to tonality, which I hear really well, some connection to forms which either evolve or sectional that I can hear, that are based on ways that things evolve, either through timbres or through melodic changes or through harmonic changes. That's the way I hear, and it's sort of when I was in Europe that first time, or for one of the first times for that long period, I really sort of came face to face with that. And
there's not always a primacy of the hearing of it.
Yeah.
In some European venues.
There's also, you know, I through the exposure to Boulez, I really think he does hear it. And I saw him do kind of almost parlor tricks with being able to hear pitches and microtones and things, which is great, but it's not my ears. That's not the way that it works.
I think what I meant by that was not the ability to hear it so much as the point being that it be heard.
Yes, I think that's right. And the other thing that I came away from that with is that I was really impressed at that point in a negative way by the by how stratified the kind of distinctions were between technicians and musicians, between performers and composers. When I came back, I came back because I was actually in not getting along so my differences with ERCOM were surfacing in my mind a lot, and I was still had not finished my doctorate at Berkeley, and they said, you know, you've either got to come back and do it or forget about it. So I tried to negotiate a lot of money from Miracom, which was a hopeless cause, and, and went back to California and went back with the idea that what I really wanted to do was somehow integrate all this stuff, keep writing, keep be involved in performing more than I had been, and also keep this sort of technological, keep my hands in the technology in a way, because that's computers and electronic music are really what I perform with.
And they were really blossoming at the time.
Yeah,
They were being, it was being becoming possible to perform with them as opposed to manage equipment.
Well, and even before that, I mean, I had been, before I went to Paris, and I started working with computers in 75, but before that I worked with synthesizers and Buchla synthesizers and Moog synthesizers and put together systems with tape delays and stuff that I would use in performance. So I'd always sort of been interested in that. And way back in the early 70s, there was in the Bay Area, there was a group called the Newport Costa Players, which was run by John Dykers, the tenor, and Janis Gatek, who is a composer from Seattle. She's wonderful, and they were married at the time.
Uh-huh.
And there were a bunch of other people in there, including Paul Drescher was around some. So I did electronics for the performances there. So I was engaged at that point in even doing performance with analog gear. But the idea of having something which I could really perform on a lot was important to me, just as what I wanted to get back to. And when I came back, finished my doctorate, got the job that I still have at Rensselaer Polytech in 1980, started in January 81, for the first time in my life, had a paycheck.
That's, you know, a real sort of convenience to that.
Right. Well, what I did immediately was go out and negotiate a loan to buy a synclavier.
Aha.
Which was had not at that point, it was like $10,000. I managed to convince the bank that this was a loan for a musical instrument that it would appreciate. Little did either of us know that it would not.
Well, until of course it became a collector's item later on.
Yeah,
a different kind of appreciation.
And I started performing, and I remember that.
Did you go to pick up your synclavier?
Oh, absolutely.
You went up to,
absolutely,
to New England Digital.
And we drove across the border to New Hampshire, where there's no sales tax, in order for me to hand Sid Alonso the check and him to hand me the box with the synclavier. And you know, I remember at that point some of the people. I think that maybe David Jaffe, who was at that point, had been at when I was first learning about computer music at Stanford, had been there and was still there, came by, and I showed him the synclavier, and he said, well, it's nice, but it's like a toy. There's all these things you can't do with it because it's so, you know, it's not a general-purpose computer like the mainframe computers we were using at Stanford and Deercom. And my reaction was, there's a whole lot that theoretically I can't do with it, but because it's something that I can practice on every day, and I can spend 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 hours working at this thing, I can get to know it in a kind of an intimacy that I never got to know the mainframes in. And plus, I can pick it up and carry it around. And you know, that lasted for a little while, and then got introduced into the fact that it all changes when a year or two later, the people at New England Digital told me that in order to keep my machine current and get involved with the new sampling that they were doing, I had to reinvest another $60,000 in it. And so I sold the synclavier, and I sold it for $9,000. For that same $9,000, I got the first generation Macintosh, first generation Prophet sampler and DX7.
DX7, a classic choice.
And that was the only choice there was.
Yeah.
And the first opcode MIDI interface, number 3 on there, and then serial number 0003. Mm-hmm. And started beta testing all of opcode stuff. And became really hooked on the idea that this changing thing is my instrument. I started at that time. I did a lot of touring around upstate New York to kind of learn about performing. There was another singer and composer named Julie Cabot, who still lives around the Capital District in New York, and she does a lot of work with arts and education. She had a lot of concerts lined up going into schools and going to community centers, and so I started doing that with her, and sort of that became my learning about performance again, and really the first time.
About what year?
This is early 80s, mid 80s, and it was very convenient. Our daughters, Julie's and my daughters, were best friends, and in fact still are. My daughter, as we're speaking now, is about to get married. Next week.
Why are you here? Oh, okay.
Next week.
Getting worried there.
Which will be July 4th, and her Julie's daughter, who is still her best friend, and now lives in Amsterdam, is flying over to be one of the bridesmaids or whatever they are.
Yeah.
So that sort of set a direction, and I worked initially first with Julie, and then started doing more and more things, either alone or with other groups. Started traveling more again. Spent in the late 80s. I spent a few months in, like 4 months in what was then Yugoslavia, right before the war. Mm-hmm. Traveling around, doing concerts, and helping the conservatory there set up a computer music situation. And I did some irregular touring in Europe. In the mid 90s, spent another 6 months in Japan. And all of that has been sort of integrating performing things around there. Because maybe I should go back and say, back to the 80s to early 90s, that one of the things that was happening for me a lot was the idea of starting up an educational program that was really unique in the country at Rensselaer. And that was turned into, in some ways, a sort of sidetracking some of my creative work for a while. But it was a really, it's been a really interesting and exciting environment that's been set up there. We started out with.
I gave a talk at Rensselaer once myself.
Oh, really?
It was a very funny story, which I'll probably tell you when we get away from the microphone. But it has to do with the vindication of coming back as a guest speaker at the school that rejected your college application.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's take a quick break, ask you what is it about fish, and play something from your CD, Fish Love Band.
Okay.
What is it about fish? I give you 60 seconds.
Well, you can if you have fish, you can reach into the little bowl after you feed them, and you sprinkle them, and they come up to get the stuff you put on top. You can grab them, and then while they're kind of wriggling in your hand, you can stroke their bellies, and fish love that.
Ah, so they do. And let's take one that almost alliterates with that. We'll play Hush from Fish Love That. Neil Rolnick. from Vision. Love that. Hush. Neil Rolnick, this is a great CD. Everybody should go out and rush right out and get a copy. This is Todd Reynolds is on here, Steve Rust, Andrew Sturman. This is just a wonderful, wonderful thing. Compositions by all of them. Deep listening. Yeah, this is Deep Listening.
And it's just out. I hope that people will go out and get it. It's on Amazon.com. You can go get it there.
You won't find much else entitled Fish Love That.
That's
so just
right.
Put that into the searcher.
Well, and
Amazon.
It's actually been very interesting for me because I haven't put out a record for a CD for 6 years. I was on other things. And and when this came out, I went looking for it listed at Barnes & Noble. It was on the line, Amazon.com. And at first couldn't find it. It's listed under Pop and Jazz.
Are you surprised?
Well, you know, I just never thought about it.
Yeah, I mean, you look at it and you start looking at it and figuring out what's on there, and there's sort of improvisatory. Well, if it has any improv, you get those four letters, that's enough to go into the jazz section right there.
Yeah. Well, and it's I've yet to see whether or not it has any impact on the sales, but this is a band that I guess when I come back from places, I come back with ideas about how I want to proceed next. When I came back from Japan in 1995 through 96, I was playing with a lot of I ran into a situation where the people that I had the most fun playing with were traditional Japanese musicians who were most open to doing things differently. We ended up doing a lot of improvisation, which I had not done a lot of before. Actually, I have a very funny story from when I was, I'll go back a long ways, when I was applying to college. And I had written a lot of music at that point and was applying for Juilliard, and went to the interview for Juilliard, and they looked at my stuff, and I played a little bit of stuff, and that was okay, and Vincent Persichetti, who was the teacher, said, now, we want you to improvise something. And I said, I don't improvise. And he said, if you're a composer, you must improvise. And I said, I'm a composer, and I don't improvise, and I'm not going to improvise. Period. And I got into Juilliard anyway.
Uh-huh.
But and it didn't go. But it was a very strange interview. College interview. Anyway, when I came back from Japan, I got to thinking that I wanted to be improvising more. And I was at the time being chairman of the department at RPI. I had a bunch of things that I was written music that I was had on my plate to write, orchestral stuff and things like that, and thought the only way that I would really make a habit of improvising was if I set up something regular.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. So I set up a monthly thing first at the Knitting Factory in New York, and then we did it at a place called Here, and this group, including Todd and Andrew and Steve and Ron Horton. I think Ron was in the original group, and Dean Sharp, who's the drummer. That group grew out of a group that I had done a theatrical piece with before I went to Japan, and it was a theater piece in which I had the computer making up the story of the theater. Each night, it would make up two stories that were different, and then the players, including the musicians and the actors, wouldn't find out until we were on stage, and it was all projected on screen. So they had been involved in this, which involves some sort of thinking about improvisation. So I called them all up, and they were all game, and we just started doing this thing, and at first, you know, for about 3 years, we did almost every month at one of the two venues. And then in the time since then, we've all kind of gone in a lot of different directions. But people have been interested in coming back whenever I can line up a gig, which is usually 2, 3, 4 times a year. And we come back, and unlike the kinds of things that each of us does separately. I mean, people do really different things. You know, Steve Rust, the bass player, plays a lot of funk stuff, and he and Dean Sharp, who are both based in Woodstock, play with all manner of jazz and rock and folk music stuff. Steve was actually on an album with James Galway a little while ago. And Todd works with, you know, Bang on a Can and Ethel, yes, and yep. Andrew works with Phil Glass a lot and also does Broadway stuff. And so, so anyway, but everyone is the deal with this band is that we can each, anyone is welcome to bring in material. At the most, we have about an hour before each gig where we look at the material, and everyone reads real fast. So,
yep.
that, you know,
good
it's,
idea.
It's all, you know, so we look at it, go through it, and then the audience is there, and we play, and it keeps everything really fresh and everyone on their toes.
Oh,
and
bet you it does. Yeah.
And you know, and I feel like they're just such good players. It's and it's a treat, and they also each one brings really different kinds of musical things to the things that they write, so that the CD has a real wide variety of stuff.
Two things. Does this influence how much you actually write in fixed compositions at this point? Has it taken away from that time?
Well,
The
way to, I'm not quite sure how to answer that. At the same time I was doing that, doing Fish Love That, I got involved in about a 6-year process of some CDs I didn't send you, but I could give you one if you want, which have nothing to do with new music. Started out with a series of commissions by David Allen Miller, who's the conductor of the Albany Symphony, and who together, we started a group called Dogs of Desire.
Yes, which was referred to by several other people.
Yeah.
So far this week.
And in the very beginning of it, you know, it was discussions with David and me together, and he was talking about really kind of wanting to do the pop, kind of pop influence things, and. So I got together with the first thing, and I wrote about six, ended up doing a series of six different songs at different times for the orchestra, for Dogs of Desire and Voices, and eventually fleshed it out with six orchestra interludes. So it was an hour's worth of music. And, of course, that all had to be written out completely. And we wrote. I ended up putting the whole thing together for them in a series, in a pair of back-to-back performances that they did in Troy, which got rave reviews for the pieces and terrible reviews for the group at the very end. And they haven't done anything of mine since.
Oh, no.
and then they dropped the record. We went through recording, making a recording, and then. I can only presume because they didn't get good reviews out of it. The record never happened. But that those sort of pop-like pieces turned into my collaborator in the words is Larry Beinhart, who is a novelist whose main recognition has been that he wrote the book that the movie Wag the Dog was based on.
Great movie.
Great movie.
Yeah.
and even better novel. The novel is called An American Hero, and I think it's put out by Pantheon, and it's that may be wrong. But anyway, it's a wonderful book. Instead of focusing on Clinton for the presidency, it focuses on Bush number one and shows how the Gulf War was set up for and by Hollywood. So the first Gulf War. So in any case, the characters that sort of emerged from these songs turned into a real story. And at first I thought that it'd be really interesting to write an opera about it. Right? And opera companies were not interested. But then Larry, who's sort of, less of a highbrow-oriented kind of guy anyway, said, oh, well, I don't like opera anyway. Why don't we send it to musical theater places? And a group called the Directors Company in New York said, we love it. We'll work with you on it. And it's never made it out of workshops. We've had, for about 3 years, we did once-a-month workshops. So actually, during the time I was doing once-a-month Fish Love That, I was also going through this process of writing. You know, I would write a couple of scenes of this musical, and all notated. The Directors Company would line up once a month actors from Broadway shows on Mondays when they don't work, pay them a little bit of money, they'd come in and do a reading and sing through what we had done, and we'd do a critique of it and go back and do some more. You know, the idea of notating improvised things, improvising, notating things completely is really a jumble in my head. I have a pretty easy time. I mean, I feel pretty fluent doing both things. Mm-hmm. I'm now... I don't know how much longer we've got to talk. Maybe it's interesting to talk about a little bit about where this has got me now.
Good, but I want to ask you one quick question.
Yes.
You let slip in department chairman, which means
yes.
Maybe you did finish that PhD somewhere along the line.
I did finish the PhD.
Oh, good. I just wanted to clarify that.
Although it's not one of the things, I mean... it's not what I think about a lot. When I first got my job, they started calling me Dr. Rolnick, and I really said, no, I'm Neil, and I will be Neil, and that's... but what actually has been good out of it is that the program, which I started to talk about before at RPI, at Rensselaer, which I've just recently stepped down from being chair after about 10 years... is something that I'm really very proud of and very excited about, and it's really moved into new areas. We started out as the first place in the country that offered MFA in electronic arts, which meant at the time computer music, video art, and computer animation, computer graphics. And that was because it was an engineering school. Those are the... I was the first of the crew to be hired when they decided they had a new arts department, which included visual and musical arts, mostly to sort of take the edge off of the engineers and their general education requirements. I found giving the same electronic music course to people who just didn't care about it really pretty stifling. So when I got tenure, which I sort of tried to avoid, but got it anyway, I thought...
Imagine anybody avoiding tenure. The
paycheck was nice, but I sort of had mixed feelings about, you know, the people who talk about tenure as golden handcuffs. I thought that it would be... if I couldn't find a way to be teaching people who were really dedicated to what I wanted to teach, that I didn't want to stick it out. And it was clear that we didn't, but there were about, I think, five people in the department, including myself and video artist John Sturgeon, computer graphics person initially, Mark Resch. It's clear that there was never going to be any kind of undergraduate program that we could make in electronic arts. There just weren't enough people in any particular area, and the field didn't really exist. So we set up an MFA program, which, to everyone's surprise, was full, and we attracted people who just didn't fit any place. They were people who liked working with computers for music, but really were also interested in visual arts, or vice versa, or there were philosophers who wanted to do things with electronics and weren't sure exactly how to put it all together. And so it kind of evolved from there, and now the people who came the very first, we opened the program in 91, and a lot of those people are teaching at major schools now, and our work is shown, you know, all over the place. So that's been really exciting. And then in the mid-90s, actually sort of before and after, before I went to Japan, we became clear that the school was going to close down the graduate program if we just kept losing money, even though we were doing, had a great program that was recognized. So we decided to start an undergraduate program in electronic media, arts, and communications, which we set up and advertised for before I went to Japan, and we were told that we'd be lucky if we got 5 people to join the program. And
who told you that?
The administration said, well, you know, the humanities and social sciences at RPI had never had more than about 20 majors in all their departments all together at any one time. So they said, if you can get 5, that'll be really great, because that's more than anyone ever gets. I came back, and they had signed up 42 students in the first class.
Nice.
And we basically went in 4 years from 0 to 300 majors. And which then brought, of course, a lot of money into the school. Again, it was the first program in the country that brought all these things together at an undergraduate level. And we've since then, there are all sorts of really interesting people there now. The person who took over for me as chair is a guy named Michael Century, who was is a Canadian who was the first director of the media program at Banff Center, mm-hmm. in the 80s, and has since been in Montreal a lot. And there's Pauline Oliveros is there now full time. There are wonderful video artists. There's Kathy High. There's a part of the group RT Mark, which is a web group. Art Mark is there. There's all sorts of interesting, and they do kind of web interactions and performance work. The musical end of things is really focused on performance with computers and with technology. So Pauline and I and Curtis Bond and Tomie Han, who is a dancer and ethnomusicologist who focuses on Japanese dance and music, and which embodies itself sometimes. And she and Curtis do things where she becomes a Japanese anime character who emits sounds from a body pack that she wears. And she also works on ethnography of monster trucks. So, you know, we have a wide range of things. And
come a long way since basket weaving.
Hello, hi, greetings, bonjour, hola. I'm Neil Rolnick, and you're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your one stop for non-pop on the Non-Pop International Network.
Here on WGDR Plainfield, where our guest is Neil B. Rolnick, and we were just listening to Macedonian Air Drumming. And we're going to go back to the interview in a little bit, but first we're going to jump right into another piece of his. This is a piece called Gate Beats.
Who, what?
Gate Beats.
Gate Beats.
Gate
oh,
Beats.
Yes.
And as he told me about it, it was a kind of neighborhood looping tour where he took little bits and pieces of music created by other folks, looped them around, and then gated it so that gradually what starts out as noise develops into the original loops.
Oh, clever.
It's kind of a reversed
yes.
fade with gate. And it's kind of an interesting little piece. He became interested in it because of, some work that the younger folks were doing, as he would say. Here it is.
Like us.
Neil, yeah, that's us. Neil B. Rolnick. This is Gate Beats.
Thank you.
Gate Beats, Neil Rolnick. Brand new, and which gives us a jumping off point to ask you what's coming up.
Well, what's coming up is this change has moving to New York, stopping working at, I'm continuing to teach at RPI, but no longer directing the program there.
In the letter you wrote, you said, shortly after moving into New York from the upstate countryside.
Yes.
And as Calvus and Damien are from Vermont, which is really the upstate countryside in yet another state,
yes.
Gave me kind of a nice smile.
Well, actually, the upstate countryside is pretty country up there. There's where we most immediately moved from was in a little town called Chatham, New York, and we were on 7 acres of nothing with the nearest neighbor about a half a mile away, and it was great, but it was also, we found that, I lived in the country for 20 years, in the 10 years since my daughter moved away from home, we've also had a pied-à-terre in New York because I was doing work regularly in the city. And at one point, and I always sort of wanted to be in the city more, and at one point my wife said, you're gone a lot, and there are turkeys and there are deer, and they don't talk very much. And maybe we should just, we had talked about when we retired moving into the city, and she said, well, why do we have to wait till we retire? We sold the place upstate, bought a place in Manhattan, and love it. We've actually found a very green corner of Manhattan.
Oh yeah, you are in. You said Upper Manhattan.
Upper Manhattan. There's this. There are beautiful parks that I can. I used to go jogging every day down little dirt roads in upstate New York. Now I go jogging through Fort Tryon Park and Inwood Park, where I'm up above the Hudson and get a beautiful view of the Hudson in New Jersey. And
we spoke to Franco Terry recently. He's just moved up to Inwood.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And he had he has many pieces about that neighborhood.
Oh, it's wonderful.
As well, compositions.
Yeah, and being in New York is wonderful both because of the musical excitement of the city. And, I'll be doing... my experience has always been that it takes about a year to get into a new place. Mm-hmm. And so, starting next year, I'll be doing a lot more performing and having things done in New York. I'll be doing a bunch of performances in the fall. They'll be doing something that... I'm not sure where it'll be, sponsored by the Electronic Music Foundation, where I'll do some solo stuff and some duet things with various people from around the city. I'll have a piece that I'm writing for the string quartet Ethel,
my co-host, Damien Gunn, has also been commissioned by Ethel.
Oh, good,
so
good.
Really,
and they're a really interesting
really
group.
Great.
And it's giving me an idea to, where I'm at right now is feeling like I now have, I'm 55 years old. I've hopefully got some considerable time left to do what I want to do. And I'm trying to look at everything that I'm doing musically and ask myself, where did I cut corners before because of whatever reason I used to cut the corners, and what do I really think about this now? And so the piece with Ethel, although I've written a number of pieces for ensembles, like Electricity that we played at the beginning of the show, they've always been, in some way, to my mind, not quite what I thought, not quite using the electronics and the acoustic instruments the way that I thought I'd like to. So I'm taking, this is... in that way, I'm really sort of rethinking that relationship. And I'm doing the same thing with my performances. I'm really rethinking about what it means to be performing on a computer. I've got ideas for different interfaces I'd like to see happen. and really rethinking what musically the as in gate beats, how I can make the music really embody what I'm thinking musically.
Well, now we'll listen to something from that point on your latest watershed.
Mm-hmm.
Neighborhood Ears, your portrait of your new neighborhood of Washington Heights.
Yes.
Neil Rolnick, thanks so much for joining us on Calvus.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Wonderful. Here it is, Neighborhood Ears. So we begin to listen to the neighborhood. Our guest, Neil Rolnick, will leave you with that and tell you that next week,
live,
Anthony Landman, Tony will be here joining us live in the studio in Calvus and Damien. And the week after that, a recording of our interview with Bruce Gremo, fresh back at the time from his stay in Rome and his work there in Italy. And then the week after that, April 3rd, Frank O'Terry of the American Music Center will join us on a recording we made there.
Nice Irish name.
Yes. He always says he has trouble with that, whether they think he's either Irish or Spanish because of Franco.
Mm-hmm.
Franco O'Terry. So, next 3 weeks, Tony Landman, Bruce Gremo, Frank O'Terry, and then we'll tell you more as we come closer to the perhaps live guests that will be joining us after that. I think that's it.
No concerts that I know of to promulgate.
All right, then let's listen to Neighborhood Ears. This is Neil B. Rolnick, and we'll hear from you next week.
Sure.
a production of Baltic Media.